Sound is.
And we're back for another episode of everyone's favourite Uzo-based podcast. Ready for another big one, Nick?
I am, mate. Certainly. Like always, I love this.
How many Uzo-based podcasts do you reckon there are?
Who knows? I'd like to say there's only one.
A quick Google search proves that there is only one, mate. We're lucky.
There you go. We're the original and the best.
Oh, dear. Look, we've had some great episodes lately, haven't we, mate?
We have, and they keep on coming. Like there's endless stories of us talking about our heritage and famous Greeks out there.
Yeah, well, today's going to be absolutely no different. We have another unique person to talk to, and we're so proud to have our first military man here in the distillery with us, Nick. I think we need to be on our best behavior today because the man we have sitting across from us is the Director General Littoral and Head of Warfare Community for the Australian Navy, would you believe?
That is huge. And you can tell he's military because he turned up on time.
He did.
We said 12:30 and the door knocks as soon as the 12:30 struck.
Is that the first one?
First one on time, I think, out of 22 episodes.
Fantastic. Well, look, he graduated from the Australian Defence Force Academy in 1991 as a distinguished graduate with a Bachelor of Science Honours in Oceanography. As a junior officer, he served in HMAS Perth, HMAS Hobart, HMAS Brisbane, HMAS Sydney, HMAS Anzac, and HMAS Stuart. In the course of these postings, he completed many deployments, including operations, international engagement, and border protection. He's commanded HMAS Arunta, HMAS Hobart, HMAS Anzac, which included an operational deployment in support of the Australian government's commitment to combating terrorism and piracy. Anzac was also awarded the Duke of Gloucester's Cup for the most outstanding unit in the fleet, the Sparta Shield, for the surface combatant foremost in operations, along with a number of other awards in the fields of electronic warfare, communications and information systems, along with supply excellence. Ashore, he's served in a number of roles, including training force, capability development, and communications and project management. He's a graduate of the Singapore Command and Staff College 2007 and the United States Naval War College in 2014. But above all else, he has a strong Greek heritage, Nick. Captain John Stavridis, welcome to Uzo Talk.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's absolutely fantastic to have you here. And look, having never served in the armed forces, I'm a bit uncomfortable about how we should be addressing you today. Do we call you Captain or how would you like to be addressed?
You can call me John, but I do have a platoon of sailors outside in case you guys start causing problems. They're coming in.
Is that why there was so much traffic today?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
VIP on the grounds here at Brighton.
Good stuff. Welcome, John. Great to have you here, mate.
Thank you.
We understand you actually listened to Uzo Talk as well. Is that right?
I do. A good friend of mine put me on the podcast so just under a year ago now, and I've listened to every episode, and
wow,
after the first episode I really bonded with what you guys are doing, because it's answering a call I think all of us have, understanding what it means to be Greek in Australia.
Fantastic. Wow. Have there been any highlights for you? I mean, we don't like tooting our own horn here, but we want to hear what's resonated with you.
Can I first start by saying how humble I am being here, because you've had quite a few amazing people. So I feel like I'm a bit of an imposter here, but certainly happy to answer any questions. But look, starting with Mary, George Ellis, Peter Manaus, just fantastic people, and quite envious of Peter and his work and Mnyazoi, and I'm very keen to get an introduction after this and hopefully be captain of his beautiful yacht one day.
Oh, geez.
Definitely.
How good would that be?
Yeah, look.
That'd be a gig.
Great gig, actually. I think he's just gone overseas again, but look, he'll be back, and hopefully he can get a boat here.
Maybe. As long as he's not wearing his Speedos, we're okay. That's my only request.
We've had two requests when we talked to PMAs. No Speedos, and at least put a shirt on.
Well, look, I mean, I don't think you need to worry about imposter syndrome today. We are absolutely honoured to have you in the room with us. And I think on that note, Nick, we're ready to have a drink. What do you reckon?
I think so.
Let's do it. Yamas, pedia. Welcome.
Yamas. Welcome, John.
We're drinking a few different things today. Everyone's sort of gone their own way with this. What have you got in your glass today?
I've just topped up with Bilava Uzo. So we're back to Uzo.
Yep.
We've run out of Plomari.
Yep.
We've got Bilava. Not a bad drop.
Yep.
However, we've had a shot of Tsipras already. So the sad thing is, Tom, we're coming to the bottom of our alcohol level. So we need to stock up somehow.
We need to stock up, yeah. Well, I think we need to head over to Millerways or at very least call Nick Andriotakis up and and say, what else can you recommend, mate?
Yeah, I think so. We've had the last of the Tsikwithia as well. So
yeah. And but John, you've got something from, I understand, your mother's home island in your glass today.
Yeah, you've obviously done your research. So you've got some Samos Uzo here. And I've only ever known Samos for its wine, which is obviously quite nice, a white musket. But you've given me a nice Samos Uzo, and that's where Mum's from, Samos. Yeah. And there's a big history with the island of Samos, going back to antiquities. And happy to bore you with any stories. I have been there many, many years ago, but it's got a great military and naval history.
Yeah,
oh, right. Wow. And before we started, we did have a shot of Tsikwithia as well, compliments of our friend Nick, which you know very well.
I was lucky enough to meet Nick about 5 years ago when I was the commanding officer of HMAS Watson. And he's from the eastern suburbs, and he graced us with his presence. We've got a lot of things in common. Yes, wine's one of them, but also a love of cars. And I met him at HMAS Watson, and he's always been very kind.
He's a good man. Well,
very good.
Obviously, today we're going to be talking about a lot of military sort of history and whatnot, and the connections that we have. Greeks have a very strong connection with the Navy and with the sea in general, don't they, John?
That's exactly right. And it comes from, as I said earlier, from antiquities. If you go all the way back to, most Greeks would know about the Battle of Salamis, but they probably don't understand how brilliant people like Themistocles actually was in executing such a battle and what it meant for the Western world in that period of growth for Greece, those golden years following the second Persian War. I mentioned Themistocles, a brilliant strategist, general, if you like, or an admiral that was able to defeat a much larger Persian navy in the Straits of Salamis. Mm. But again, just starting at Salamis would be wrong. You'd have to go back 10 years and look at even those greats like General Miltiades. He was able to win at Battle of Marathon, which I think most Greeks would know. And then, of course, who wouldn't know the Spartans at Thermopylae with King Leonidas and his famous quote, Molon Lave. And if you ever come to Canberra, come into my office, I've got a plaque that actually says Molon Lave. And for those of your listeners that don't know what that is, when the Persians said, put down your arms and let us pass, his response was Molon Lave, or come and get them. And I think that really defines the Greek spirit, that Greek fighting spirit.
I think that's actually the Greek military's motto in some respect, I think.
I wasn't aware of that, but it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you mentioned Salamis, because we were, you know, we've obviously done our research, and it plays such a huge part in high school teaching in this day and age. I mean, I studied the Greco-Persian Wars when I was in high school. I want to talk a little bit about Salamis. I'm so glad you mentioned it. So, because, again, as we said, Greece's connection with the Navy stretches back thousands of years. And actually, this year marks 2,502 years since the Battle of Salamis between the Greeks and the Persians. As I said, it's something that's taught in schools even today. Let me tell you a little bit about it for those who maybe aren't familiar with the battle. The Battle of Salamis was fought in 480 BC as one of the decisive battles in the Greco-Persian Wars, and it's considered to be the first great naval battle in recorded history, and is famed because the Greek fleet, as John's just mentioned, defeated what was a much larger Persian naval force in the Straits of Salamis under the command of Themistocles. By 480 BC, the Persian king Xerxes and his army had overrun much of Greece, and his navy of about 800 galleys bottled up the smaller Greek fleet of about 370 triremes in the Saronic Gulf. Themistocles lured the Persian fleet into the narrow waters of the Strait at Salamis, where he knew that the massed Persian ships would have difficulty manoeuvring. The Greek triremes, incredible technology for the day, then attacked furiously, ramming and sinking Persian vessels while boarding others. In all, the Greeks sank about 300 Persian vessels, while losing only about 40 of their own. The rest of the Persian fleet was scattered, and as a result, Xerxes had to postpone his planned land offensives for a year, a delay that gave the Greek city-states time to unite against him. I mean, John, obviously you know a lot of this history. Is this stuff that's taught, you know, naval academies in Australia?
I certainly teach it. I've got a strong training background. Indeed, my next job from next year will be Commodore Training, which is in charge of all of training throughout Navy. And I've always used those examples. of great strategy and tactics to achieve a victory, especially when you look at the Greeks were vastly outnumbered. And it's not just a matter of looking at the strength of the navy, but the tactics and strategy, and indeed the doctrine that underpins all of that, that led to the Greek victory. And indeed, to truly understand the significance of Salamis, you do have to start 10 years earlier at the Battle of Marathon, again, where I mentioned General Miltiades was able to have that initial defeat. And I think most Greeks would understand with Darius having told his servant three times a day, and master, remember the Athenians, because that's how much of a threat he found them. And history started, again, without boring your audience, some years
that's
earlier
what you want,
when
no.
The Athenians actually went to Ionia, which is Western Anatolia, or as most would know where my background is Asia Minor. Mm-hmm. The Greeks there were revolting. The Athenians supported them. Darius the First eventually overwhelmed them, and then to wreak his revenge, he sent a number of triremes and the Battle of Marathon, where he was defeated. And for the next 6 years, he was focused on reattacking the Greek states, and that's where his servant was telling him three times a day, master, remember the Athenians. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for Darius, he died 6 years later during an Egyptian revolt, but his son Xerxes, as you mentioned, Tom, try to finish the battle. This time they came up through the Hellespont, down, were met at Thermopylae, and that's where the Spartans made the stand, the 300 Spartans, which we all know. But what you also need to understand, there was a naval battle at the same time, the Battle of Atesium, which Themistocles was in charge of, and there was no victory in that battle, but Themistocles knew the land battle had been lost, Athens had fallen, and that's when he lured the Persians into the Salamis, the classic home advantage. He understood those waters. He understood the tides. He understood sunrise timings, etc. He understood when the winds would start, and therefore had that advantage. And yes, he lured them by really pushing Xerxes' buttons. Xerxes was watching there on the coast and saw his whole fleet being annihilated. Yeah. That led to that glory of Greece. But there were two key battles after that, Plataea, which I think most people would know. So a year after, which largely destroyed the Persian armies and navy. Cool. And just off my mum's island at Athens, at Mykale, Leotihidas, which is the second king of Sparta, defeated the remnants of the Persian army. And that's when Greece was able to flourish.
Wow. What a story.
Wow.
I mean, I'm so pleased in general, though, that you are using these stories as part of training now, or looking to use them. How important do you think it is to be able to do stuff like that?
It's very important. When we teach our, and we've got one of the best training systems in the world, no doubt. And I'm not an arrogant person, but we certainly spend a lot of time training and preparing our people for the roles they do. And yes, teaching tactics and strategy and doctrine are all very important, but you have to be able to base that on some type of history and lessons from history. Mm. Not, as people say, that, you know, we're scared that history will repeat itself. Not at all. But history, as one of my admirals would tell me, history does rhyme. And being able to apply those conditions to what you see today, to either come up with your own strategy, or as I do, and I'm not a historian, but I certainly read a lot, what would I have done in those circumstances?
Yeah.
And to test myself, am I actually ready? And what I tell my sailors is, all you need to be is 1% better than a potential adversary. So to outsmart, outthink, outmaneuver, and outperform what they do.
Wow. And I mean, you mentioned the name Themistocles there, someone who is revered as an incredible military tactician, but also a politician, because so much of the success of those battles came from what was effectively a complex bluff from him, trying to persuade the Athenian state to spend money on triremes as opposed to, you know, doling up the city and whatnot, but not actually saying that we should be ready for the Persians. He was getting them ready to come up against Aegina, is my understanding. It's an incredible political bluff.
Yeah, potentially a bluff, but also just a great mind. And as you'd know, Tom, Athens had discovered those silver mines.
Mm, yes.
And they were about to come across quite a bit of money. And he convinced the Athenians, let's not splurge the money, but invest in a navy. Because he knew a navy would stop the Persians attacking. And it largely did. If Athens did not have that navy, they would not have been able to win at Salamis.
But even just in saying that as well, you mentioned earlier, Tom, that he tried to convince the Athenians to invest in navy, but if he'd mentioned invest in the navy to stop the Persians, he reckoned he would have got a revolt.
Yeah, many historians actually say that they thought it was too soon to be mentioning the Persians again. because it would be too sore a spot for them. So, I mean, brilliant tactics from all, you know, from all angles, you know, and such an inspiration, isn't it?
Yeah, and he did. And he convinced them. Why? Because they had a threat from Evia.
Egina. Small island, basically opposite.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
There you go. So you talked about the training, John. So give us some examples of what you teach today to the Australian Navy. And when you refer to tactics, do you specifically focus on the Battle of Salamis and things like that?
Absolutely. So they're just historical examples, but I also focus very much on Australian naval battles too, because things like Salamis are very important to make a point about strategy and tactics, certainly using the environment and how to potentially put yourself in a superior position if you have less assets. But I also try and use quite a few Australian Navy examples. And again, Australian Navy is only over a century old. We got the title Royal in 1911, and our first replacement fleet was in 1913. So we're very, very young Navy, and we've had some incredible successes. Indeed, the HMAS Sydney 1, when it's taking that valuable cargo of Anzacs from Albany to initially Egypt before they went to Limnos and Mudros Harbour, which, by the way, is where my dad is from, and growing up, I'd hear these stories of the Anzacs and certainly inspired me. But our first victory was HMAS Sydney in the Indian Ocean on the way to taking those Anzacs to Egypt. And they'd come across a German cruiser, the Emden. It's a wonderful story. The Emden had gone to Cocos Islands to destroy a communications tower, which they did. And look, on another day, I'll tell you the full story. But the German raider party went ashore, found the communication station, which was also where they stored the island Scotch, their whiskey. And they destroyed
important cargo.
And the islanders came across, what are you doing?
Yep.
Oh, we're destroying your communications mast. No, that's where we store our whiskey. And they both looked in, what have we just done? But unbeknownst to that...
priorities.
Absolutely. Wow. Unbeknownst to that raiding party, the Emden was being engaged by Sydney. Just by sheer chance, both Sydney and Melbourne happened to be in the area. Sydney was detached to engage, and they won their first victory. The Navy was only a few years old and had achieved such success. But other examples I use of Australian Navy victories in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. My first ever ship I went on was the HMAS Perth. Mm. And I was a junior officer, just finished the academy, and they had just come back from the 50th anniversary of the commemoration of Battle of Crete. And that's the first time I ever tried raki. And here we're having senior naval officers to me, teaching me about the Cretan culture and how much they loved being in Greece. And I thought, this is fantastic. And they were telling me of their stories of famous battles like Cape Sparta and later Battle of Cape Matapan. World War II battles that the Australian Navy was involved in, and I use those to show our officers and sailors what it means to be an officer and sailor in the Royal Australian Navy and what victory and success looks like.
Wow, unbelievable. Well, what actually drew you to the Navy, John? I mean, obviously you've got it somewhat running through your blood, you know, with your Greek heritage, but what is it that made you think the Navy's for me?
It's a good question. There is some background with military. My papa from mum's side had spent 20 years in the Hellenic Navy. That's where he met my yaya. When he was from Syros, but when they went to Samos, he met my yaya there. My dad served in the military. He did active service in Korea. He was a military policeman with the Hellenic military.
Okay.
But ever since I can remember as a young kid, I always loved aircraft, planes, ships, anything military. And I'd have lots of books and anything military. But I do remember having one open day where the Navy ships were open. Dad took me down there. I thought, no, this is it. I absolutely loved it. But I guess the real question is, what keeps me in the Navy? Let's be honest, the real reason is that sense of service that I think we all have. You know, that selfless character that you put the interests of our nation before your own. And with service comes, of course, sacrifice. And the Navy is very good at repaying that sense of service by educating us, growing, developing, professional development. And it's certainly, every day I put the uniform on, I feel that that sense of service. But I know previously you've had other people on here, and service does not necessarily mean just being in the military. Eleni Zahos that you had, our wonderful nurses, our volunteers, our policemen, our fireys, our paramedics that do all this great work, sacrificing their time for the greater good of our nation. And I think that's what that sense of service that we all feel. And indeed, I really enjoy that episode with Eleni, because You know, she shows the character of those wonderful 300 Australian nurses that served in Lemnos, my dad's island, just before and during the Anzac campaign at Gallipoli.
We talk about that sense of service. Like, how difficult would it be for you? I get the same sense with you that I did with Eleni that you just mentioned there. It would be hard for you, I imagine, to remove yourself from the Navy because of that sense of responsibility. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, but we all eventually have to retire. Mm. But you still can serve in other ways. And certainly you can help your kids at school, through the community, helping out elderly, volunteering. People say you never actually really retire from the Navy, and you can also continue contributing. But yep, that sense of... that service that you get certainly keeps me wanting to be in the Navy. But can I say I've been in the Navy since I left school, so without aging myself, over 30 years.
Yeah.
But most people do a few years, get their trade, get their education, get some life experience, and then move on to other careers. Mm. Some even come back after a second career.
Is that a common theme, though, in the Navy, to have a long career? Once you start, you sort of never leave?
No, not at all. This is unusual to be in 30 plus years. Most do around the 10 year mark. Some do less. Mm-hmm. A few do more, and it depends on people's circumstances. If they've achieved their life goals, they've achieved that sense of service that they potentially may have wanted, or other things come in. But as I said earlier, you don't really leave the Navy, and you're always welcome to come back should you leave for other reasons, family. Going to do some study, trying another career, whatever it may be.
Yeah, right. You have what we understand is a distant relative in the US Navy, Admiral James Stavridis, who was recently on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Tell us about a little bit of your connection there.
Look, I'm quite proud to know him. I've met him a few times, including when I was in the US at the Naval War College, and he was Dean of Tufts in Boston. And he's one of our great minds. He's an accomplished naval admiral, four-star admiral. He was in charge of NATO, his final job in the United States Navy. But he's also one of the greatest minds and strategists. He would probably be quite upset that I'd compare him to someone like Mahan or Corbett, which are two great strategists. But he certainly is. He writes a lot, and he also has this passion for developing junior officers into making them better tacticians. He's written profusely. He's got a lot of books on strategy, naval history, and also his recent foray into fiction with his novel 2034. But even in there, you could see he's always pushing junior sailors and junior officers to think about what if. So it's a great book to read.
I mean, he's going to be someone who, in the future, and even now, I suspect that people are, you know, in colleges and universities around the world are going to be looking at his books and using him as a source, you know, and he's a historical source now for military tactics and naval tactics, isn't he?
He certainly is, and he's read extensively. And what I love about some of his books, like The Leader's Bookshelf, is if you don't have time to read the books or you don't have time to do Wikipedia, read one of his books and you'll be a master across many subjects very, very quickly. And he's very generous with his time.
Mm. Wow. So a four-star general, tell us what that entails.
So he's a four-star admiral, which is a full admiral. And just to get a sense of perspective, after 30 years in the Navy, I'm what's now in star ranks a one-star, a commodore. The US would call that a rear admiral, lower half. Then you have a two-star. The head of our Navy is a three-star admiral, Vice Admiral Mark Hammond. And the head of our Defence Force is a four-star general. So that's a level that we're talking about. And that was his last job for Admiral Stavridis, in charge of NATO as a four-star admiral.
Is there a close family connection with him, or is he sort of distant for you guys?
Yeah, so with a surname like Stavridis, and I've researched it, means son of Stavros. It's not an uncommon name. It's not one of the most common Greek names. Yep. Certainly not uncommon. But we've traced back our heritage to our Western Anatolia, so Asia Minor, which a lot of Greeks have come from.
What town that is?
No, I don't. Okay. That's what we're trying to work out. But we believe our great-grandparents came from the same area, moved to Thessaloniki, and from there my great-grandparents moved to Limnos. That's the link. So that's where we think we've come from.
And did James's ancestors do the same trek, or did
Absolutely.
They go to the same
I believe they went to Thessaloniki, but from there I'm not sure where they went after that. But I do know his father, who was a colonel in the US Marine Corps. James, like me, was born locally in the US, and myself in Australia.
Okay, so just back to you, mate. So your rank is a Commodore, one-star admiral. So what does that entail?
Commodore. So in the Australian Navy, a Commodore is a star rank, the one-star.
What does
that
mean?
It's to put in perspective, it's one rank above captain, or for your Greek audience, a pliarchos. So if anyone listening in Greek, archipliarchos is my rank, which is a one star, or as we say in our Navy, a commodore. And to get an understanding, a commander, so an antipliarchos, three stripes on your shoulders or your sleeve, depending on what uniform you're wearing, is generally the captain of our ship. So when I say captain, it's a rank, but it's also a position. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, we have captains, which is four stripes, and they can either be in charge of our big ships, our landing hulls or our destroyers, or a fleet or a flotilla of ships. And then you have commodores. And commodores, in my case, my current responsibility, head of Navy Warfare Community, where I'm responsible for looking after the technical mastery of our sailors and officers, making the best they possibly can be in their education, exposure and experience in their technical trade. We also look at social mastery. We also look at mariner mastery, but my real focus is on that technical skill. But my day job is as Director General of Littoral. And what that means, it's in a capability development role. So we've got our current in-service ships, our submarines, our aircraft. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the future, what's coming up next. And as part of that, our Defence Strategic Review is looking at the next 10 years. And my focus is on the littoral environment, so patrol boats, mine warfare, mine hunters, military geospatial, military survey, our maritime combat support vessels, and the like.
So you're focusing more on the technology piece coming in the future and how we're going to manage that. Do you touch on drones at all, by any chance?
Yes, we do. And drones is a key part of future technologies. We're already using robotic and autonomous systems, what you may call drones, and artificial intelligence. For example, for our deployed mine countermeasures, we use robots to do that role. We don't want to be sending sailors in a minefield to clean mines, so we use unmanned surface vessels and also robotic systems to do that work for us.
Is there a lot of that around at the moment in terms of mines and whatnot?
Of the of mines,
yeah.
So mines are a definite threat.
Really,
it's a cheap way of achieving what they call sea denial, stop a navy or even merchant marine using an area due to the threat of mines. So it's important, given that what the role of the navy is, and people ask me, what does the navy do? Yes, our motto is to fight and win at sea. But what we're there to do is to defend and deter attacks on Australia, and indeed keep our sea lanes of communication, our economy open. 98% of Australia's trade comes by sea, and you need a strong navy to keep those ports open, but also to assure the sea lines of communication, and if required, stop another adversary from impeding our ability to trade worldwide.
What about submarines? Is there someone like you looking after submarines and, you know, the sort of technology that needs to be brought into the navy?
Absolutely. So submarines is not under my remit. There are five capability programs in the Navy. I run two of them, which I've already mentioned, but we have service combatants and aviation. Another one is submarines. But the submarines is really split into two areas. We've now got our nuclear task force, which is looking at that AUKUS, the move to acquire nuclear submarines for Australia. And when I mean nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, not nuclear-armed submarines.
Right.
And the reason that's important is submarines are very, very quiet. They're stealthy, and they can achieve quite a large leverage effect if you understand for their size what they can actually do. But a diesel submarine, as quiet as it can be, has two problems. It is rather slow, and it also has to surface every so often, i.e. come to the surface, get in there, and recharge its batteries.
Right.
Nuclear is only limited by food. That's it. It can make its own water, its own air.
Wow.
So it's a range of its people as opposed to submarine. It can stay submerged indefinitely.
What, for a year? Who knows? As long as
depending on
what
the
food.
Role of the submarine is. Wow. And that's why they have such a strategic deterrence effect, because it's really hard to find them.
Look, I just want to take it back. So December 2016, you commanded Australia's first Aegis destroyer, HMAS Hobart. Tell us what that felt like.
It was a real honour. So I was lucky enough to have commanded two Anzac frigates before that, very, very capable ships. And look, I was lucky to get one command and blessed to get a second command. But when I got the call from the Admiral to command Hobart, which is our first Aegis destroyer, it was certainly a real honour. These are very, very capable and lethal ships. And central to their success is not just the size and the weapons they have on them, but the Aegis combat system. And a combat system is really a computer system that manages all your sensors, your radars, your optics, and your weapons. And it helps the tacticians or the strategists in the ship achieve those effects. The speed of modern warfare is such that we can't react as quick as a missile or a gun. So we actually have our sensors, our radars, electronic warfare, our optical systems, our sonars, and the Aegis combat system helps us program that to automatically respond if required. But we're ultimately in control. So right. we program the system to respond under certain threats. And the real core of the warfare officer is understanding when that paradigm's changed and when you need to reprogram your system.
Okay, so who's making these things? Is this primarily US technology, or is some of this even being created here?
Really good question. So the Aegis combat system is US, made by a company called Lockheed Martin, but it also integrates with a lot of other systems and sensors and weapons, such from Raytheon. But in Australia, we also have in our ANZAC frigates a Saab combat system, which is, whilst initially developed overseas, is largely being further developed in Australia. And for our future frigates, you'll see a combination of both the Saab combat system and the Aegis one together, and we'll get the best of both worlds.
So it really is a sort of yin and yang sort of thing, isn't it? You know, if one system's not picking something up, another one... You know, the other one is sort of, filling in the gaps. Is that fair to say?
Largely. They do different roles, depending on what weapons or sensors they're coordinating. Aegis was built, and really its key success is in air warfare, defending against aircraft, missiles, etc.
Okay. Wow. Everyone hears how, large, for example, the US Navy is. You know, we're talking about things like aircraft carriers and, state-of-the-art destroyers and whatnot. How do we sort of fit into that in terms of the overall scheme of things? They're obviously massive, but how do we fit in terms of scale?
The US is a superpower. There's no real comparison. We'd be described as a medium maritime power, based on the size of our Navy. But again, there's no comparison with what the sheer size of the US. But we do, they are an ally. We do train with them quite a bit, and certainly help develop tactics and procedures and techniques with them. But as we do with a lot of other navies, a Navy just doesn't exist to fight. There's quite a few missions. Apart from war fighting, the other mission we have is constabulary, looking after our borders, and the other one is diplomatic, getting around, waving that flag, meeting other navies, and setting up and helping foster relationships. And that's certainly an important part of the Navy, and we exercise with other navies quite regularly.
Mm. So is the US Navy the biggest in the world, without a doubt?
It depends how you define size. The Chinese PLA Navy is quite a large navy now too. Mm-hmm. And depending on how you measure by tonnage or by sheer number of ships, but certainly the PLA Navy and the US Navy would be the biggest navies in the world.
Wow. Yeah, right. And have you had any war games with the US? You said you did some exercises with the other Navy.
Yeah,
personnel.
Regularly we do exercises. A recent one was the Rimbeth Pacific or RIMPAC exercises, which I think that 2012 Battleship movie was based on a RIMPAC type exercise. Whatever you think of that movie, there's lots of great war movies certainly around. I used to watch a lot of them when I was growing up. But yeah, exercising with our navies is certainly important.
And what does it entail? Does it entail submarines, planes, battleships? And do you take on the US in these exercises, or you're on the same team, or it depends?
It depends. We always have a red force, an opposition that we train against. And certainly when I was a commanding officer, I would put my best and brightest on that red team to get them to think as a potential adversary or an enemy would think, and therefore to test our own tactics, techniques and procedures. So what you'd have is all the navies exercising, and you'd pick a small force or a large force, and you'd make, hey, you guys are the bad team or the red team, and we'll practice against each other. And then after that, we have a whole bunch of lessons learned and update our techniques, tactics and procedures.
Wow. Just like being a kid, Tom, playing cowboys and Indians. Right?
Doing things like that, those types of exercises, is that where the majority of tactics and procedures and whatnot are really sort of put to the test? Or are there, what other means does the Navy have to sort of get to a state of readiness?
It's a really good question. Yes, exercising and benchmarking is important. We also have a whole bunch of other organisations and groups that help us. For example, our Defence Science and Technology Group do a lot of research into weapons and tactics and also help inform our own procedures. So that is certainly key. Being able to travel the world and exercise with other navies, we learn, we develop, especially with our allies. And I've been lucky enough to travel the world. Unfortunately, I've never been to Greece or Europe. I've always missed out on the European deployments, but a long time in the Americas, the Pacific, Southeast Asia, Indian Ocean, and Middle East. And indeed, when I was in command of HMAS Anzac, as you mentioned in your introduction, we spent a bit of time in the Middle East, including chasing pirates. But one of the most memorable moments I had there was our interactions with the Greek ships and Greek sailors and officers. And I remember...
so you have interacted with them.
Oh, we have, absolutely. Yeah, wow. And it's not just the at-sea interaction. A big part of it is where socially we interact and learn from each other. And I remember my first... I was a Plutarchy, so a junior officer, a lieutenant commander, and it was our first visit to Bahrain. Mm-hmm. And we were told to go next to a Greek ship, the HS Hellenic ship Adrias, which is a Cortina class, a very, very capable ship. And we berthed alongside it, and I was on the upper decks there helping with the lines. And I remember two Greek sailors just watching there, and clearly their eye picked up one of our sailors, and they're saying, you know, how Omorfi. And I said, no, Omorfi. Then, you know, and
is there female sailors?
We have females, of course. About a quarter of our navy is female. Yep. And I responded, no, Omorfi nasasistiso. You know, and Bahasane, they really lost it. They said, Dinasise. Wow. And we had a really good relationship. As soon as our lines were there, they invited our commanding officer across there for coffee, and we got on really, really well. And you can't make this up. My next trip to Bahrain, we went outboard another Greek ship. It's a Miko frigate, HS Idra. Mm. And so the Miko frigate is exactly like our Anzac frigates. So right. They put different weapons and systems on them, but almost the twin ship. We went alongside, and you know, my captain was having troubles lining the ships up. And you can imagine a 4,000-ton frigate trying to move it even a metre. It's quite challenging. So we're doing it by ropes. Anyway, we put our gangway across, and my XO, a good friend of mine now, said, John, you speak Greek, can you tell them to move the Greek ship to move our lines? And, you know, my Greek's okay, but, you know, I thought, I'm going to create an international incident here, so I better be careful what I say. Yeah. So there I was in my spasmana, in your car, saying, oh, you know, signor me, put it in. Anyway, and on the back of the ship, the flight deck, you can imagine, where all the pilots and the aviators are. He said, "Re, Elinas, you say." I said, "No, to Australia, Elinas." Yeah, I said, "Sparo café."
Straight away.
Go for coffee. I'm busy. Can you move? No, this frappe. Taxi frappe. Okay. Megala. Okay. And there I was. Exactly. There I was on the flight deck. You know, my captain trying to move the ship, and I'm drinking this iced coffee, looking at him going, "Then I can't. What am I going to do?" But we had a great relationship with the
so he sent you over to do a job, and he looks down, and you're having a frappe.
That's so Greek. Jesus.
As I said earlier, diplomatic relations. It was more important at that stage.
It's customary.
He's brilliant. Yeah, wow. So are there many Greek Australians or Greek Americans in the Navy that you know of?
I couldn't tell you a number. I regularly come across someone with a Greek name, but you know, are they first generation? Are they second generation?
Yep.
But it's something that's really hard to track, because we don't actually ask that question. Are you of a Greek background? I guess the only way you could really do it is ask if they're Greek Orthodox. But even then, that would not really tell the full picture.
Ethnicity. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating.
I mean, there must be heaps, though. Just in my family, for example, there's such a strong connection with the Navy. I had to write it down. So I've got a cousin, Captain Spiro Mazarakiou, who's in the Greek Navy. His father, my Theo Michali, was also in the Navy as well. Plenty of stories about war games with the US Navy as well.
And you got a US Navy connection, didn't you say?
I do. I have my cousin Spiros Skias, who was in the US Navy as a sailor. And his first captain, would you believe, was actually Greek. Xeftetis was his name, he told me the other day. My uncle Yorgo Poulimenou was in the Greek Navy band as well.
Yeah.
And I had an uncle, Nikos Tsamardinos, who died in the Express Seminar accident, believe it or not, who was also in the Navy. So very strong.
Massive connection.
Yeah. I think you said, Tom, it's in our blood.
It absolutely is.
And I think the Greeks certainly understand the importance of being in the Mediterranean there, the importance of a navy to a nation. So it's always good to hear of other Greeks doing it. And people have asked me, what is it about being Greek and the Navy? And I think it's questions we always ask ourselves. What is it about being Greek? What defines a Greek? And certainly second generation, what is it that, you know, we connect? You know, is it nationality? No. Is it ethnicity? Probably. And you mentioned Nick Admiral James Stavridis earlier. And he was once asked, when he was in charge of NATO, what do you define as a Greek? And he said there were three things which really struck a chord with me. And he said, to be a Greek, you have to be optimistic. And I think we'll find that a lot of Greeks.
Mm.
He said, philoxenia, you know, the love of a stranger is common. And you've mentioned that in previous episodes. And the love of learning. If those three resonate with you, then you're probably Greek. And I think that's spot on. And if the Admiral was here, I'd question the optimism. I think he's probably right on optimism as opposed to hope. You know, hope is you hope things will get better, but optimism is you know things will get better.
Mm.
And if you look at the history of Greeks, I think there's a whole history there. But my in-laws are from Cyprus, and my mother-in-law is from Adazepo and Larnaca. And most people may not know this, but that's the town where Zeno of Kitymor, Larnaca, was from, and he started the school of Stoicism. And I think that Stoicism is what really defines Greeks. And for those that are unaware what Stoicism or being Stoic is bad things or unwarranted things will happen to us, but what we control, and we can't control that, but what we can control is how we react, our attitude and our response. And I think that's very typically Greek. And the other thing I would add to philoxenia is I think something my parents taught me strongly is philotimo.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that love of duty and doing the right thing. So those five things are what I think defines Greek, and what us as now Greek Australians can bring to Australia and teach other people in Australia those great strong values that help you in so many things in life.
It's great that you mentioned that, because I want to understand, what was your upbringing like growing up in a Greek Australian family here in Australia? What sort of things did your parents instill in you?
I think it's like most first generation Greeks growing up. So I grew up in Elwood, like I think.
Sure.
I feel most of Elwood is Greek. And I looked at the census data. Elwood's a bit like a Greek island. It's about 20,000 people, and 23% of Elwood are Greek. So one in four people are Greek.
Wow.
But what is amazing about that is in the previous census, it was only 17%. So somehow
it's
growing.
That's unbelievable.
So something's attracting.
The kids never leave.
So whilst I might be in Canberra now, I certainly grew up in Elwood, and my memories there are like most kids, just playing, growing up, going to Greek school, being forced to go to Greek school like everyone else. But there were some great stories even there at Greek school, going to church. And mum was very, very religious, and she certainly instilled that love of God. To me, it's important. What gives me a lot of my strength is love of God and our orthodoxy. But she certainly taught me that philotimor, the philoxenia, but also I remember something from my dad especially is gorai, or courage. This is something I also teach my sailors and officers in our Navy, and in fact my kids, is the difference between bravery and having courage. The brave person, as I tell my kids, is someone quite rare, someone that does those really hard things, they don't even think about it, they just do it. And indeed, one of our values in the Defence Force, I've mentioned service, the other one is courage. We don't actually ask our sailors or our soldiers to be brave, but what we do ask them is to be courageous. And the difference is, the courageous person is actually quite scared, you know, but they'll still do the right thing, either moral courage or physical courage. So that's what I ask them. You can be scared, but that's okay. Do the right thing. That's certainly something my dad
great message.
And it puts it in perspective that, you know, you don't have to be a special person to do the right thing.
Yeah. I guess that's what helps us what draws you and I, people like you and I, Nico, who haven't served in the armed forces, but what draws us to seeing these films, what inspires us in the books that we read and the documentaries that we watch. I mean, you and I have, you know, vast experience in watching things like that.
Yeah.
Surely that's something that you would draw inspiration from.
Yeah, definitely. Look, and just the stuff that you said, John, it just summed it up. You know, the philotimor, always willing to learn, you know, being optimistic. I think nearly everyone we've had on our show is like that.
Yeah.
That's why Greeks are so prosperous, but you never hear about it because we were quite humble about it. And the more people we meet, like yourself, John, there's a lot of successful people with Greek heritage because they got those values. You know, we're not good at promoting our own ancestry or our own what we do really well. But however, it does come through in our titles and things and our achievements. So yeah, look, I'm trying to digest what you just said before. That's just fantastic stuff.
But I'm glad you mentioned humility too. I think you know, Greek Australians should be very proud of what they've achieved. But humility is another strong value. And people shouldn't see humility as a sign of weakness or being timid.
Beautiful.
It relates very well with philoxenia and that philotimo. But and again,
it's a great point that you said, because people do see it as a sign of weakness. I've got this guy; he's weak because he's being really nice and he's friendly. But no, it's our upbringing; it's our nature. That's what we're like. Doesn't mean you're weak or you're a wimp. Mm. It's really, I just can't believe you just mentioned all this.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Again, when I talk to even my family or my sailors and officers of what it is to be in the Navy, what it is to be a young person, whatever it may be, you want to be careful if people tell you, oh, it's in your nature to be strong and heroic. No, look at your values, and your values are what determine how you respond to adversity or whatever may happen in your life. And again, for those that are younger or may have a papu or their parents who are getting elderly, speak to them. They've gone through so much. The generation that came out here, having lived through World War II, and the Greek population in World War II declined quite a bit. I think it was about 7 or 8%. I think 500,000 people died during World War II.
Why? Well, 10% of the Greek male population was wiped out.
That wouldn't surprise me. Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And again, most people that are celebrated or are aware of 1821 and the Greek War of Independence, but the Greek War of Independence didn't just happen in 1 year and then, you know, they were liberated. Some of the islands took, in fact, Kastellorizo took until, which is only 2 kilometres, for those that don't know, it's 2 kilometres off the coast of Turkey as part of the Dodecanese. It was liberated in 1948. Most of the Aegean islands, including my dad's island of Limnos, was liberated in around 1912, 1913. So it took them over 100 years. Crete, I think 1908, even though it had been semi-autonomous for some period. So it took the Greeks a long time to get independence. And then to find, you know, and you've got the Greek-Turkish War of 1919 to 1922 and the great population exchange.
Yes.
But then, you know, to be invaded by the Italians and the Orchidae. You know, they're saying, we just won our freedom. We're not about to give it back. And they fought hard against the Italians and later the Germans. And they found a lot of reprisals from the German. There were a lot of massacres against the Greek population. But also that great famine of 1941-42. I remember my mum and dad telling me they were eating seeds, trying to find things in the hills because there was no food.
Yeah.
And there isn't no food. The Germans, the Axis powers, were taking resources away from Greece. And there was also that blockade too by the Allies on Greece. And again, one of the reasons that blockade was lifted to lift the famine was the Greek diaspora. People living internationally saying, stop doing this to Greece. And the Allies did lift the blockade on Greece. Another example of Greek diaspora, people living around the world, was a gentleman by the name of Yuri Osaverov. Now, if you've been to Greece, you may have come across one of the museum ships here, Verov. I think it's currently in Thessaloniki, but it's been in Salamis too. This is a famous ship. So this Yuri Osaverov, I think it was in Egypt, but of Greek descent, paid for a significant amount of this cruiser. And this was a post-dreadnought cruiser, one of the most modern cruisers, and it almost single-handedly liberated the islands of the Aegean. Kept the Ottoman Navy in the Dardanelles. There was quite a few famous battles, the Battle of Lemnos in 1913, the Battle of Elie in 1912, and it went round slowly liberating all these islands, including my dad's island of Lemnos. And, you know, like my style, it changed from Byzantines to Venetians, Greeks and Ottomans. And, you know, the story of these Greek sailors going in the island, liberating them, and the Greek kids saying, who are you? And they're saying, we're Hellenists. And they ask them, well, who are you? We're Romei. You know, the Romei as opposed to the Eastern Roman Empire, right?
Yeah.
That's how long they'd been under occupation.
Wow. Yeah.
And
so Romei are from Constantinople.
They are, the Eastern Rome, right? So Rome never actually, the Roman Empire never actually just ended it. Under Constantine III, he moved to Constantinople, and it flourished there for another 1,000 years. And that's why you've had so many Greeks in Anatolia, Western Anatolia, even the Bondi up in the Black Sea region.
Because I do hear that a lot. We're Romei. We're Greek, but Romei. Yep. So that means they're from Asia Minor.
Absolutely, the Eastern. And I'm not a historian. This is just the reading I do. Because I've been on that journey too, trying to understand, where have I come from? What does it mean to be, a first generation Greek in Australia? That of Verov is another great example.
A great story
of naval and gunboat diplomacy in the Aegean.
We mentioned females in the Navy, in the Australian Navy now. There's a great example of the world's first female admiral, and that was in the Greek Navy in the form of Bubulina, who obviously paid for her own Navy. She was obviously a wealthy woman. I mean, Is that something that you're aware of, or something that you've sort of taken on board in terms of your teachings?
You know,
I'm guessing not, because you're writing it
down. No, I'm writing it down because you've sparked my interest here. This is something I want to.
So my understanding, and you know, Nick, you can probably look this up while we're talking. But Bubulina, as far as I'm aware, was actually the first female admiral in the world. She was a wealthy woman. She managed to, you know, have her own navy which she paid for.
She had the title of a Greek naval commander.
There you go.
So Kivanitis, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So she was. She went around during the War of Independence and was, was single-handedly involved in the liberation of a number of islands. I think, Nick.
Definitely. Yeah. She was born in Constantinople as well. So. Mm. She, her family was quite well off, and she essentially bought a navy, looked at liberating, again, it's too much to read, but she was part of the Greek War of Independence and liberated Greeks to the like and islands and so forth. But yeah, interesting story. Yeah,
no, there's a lot to learn. We're quite progressive.
Yeah, no, it's a good call out, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. I'm so looking forward to doing some research on it, but it's so important that we do understand as Greek Australians that history, how those are just, I'm guessing Bubulina too, would just be normal people that rose to the challenge. And the question is, what is it? What were those values that helped them rise to the challenge?
Absolutely.
Come through adversity. And if I might steal that example, I've been asked by the Lemnian Association here in Sydney to speak next month. So October for most Greeks is a pretty big month, right? And when you look at it, why? Orchidae is a classic, but also the liberation from the Germans in October 1944 was another one. The signing of the armistice against the Ottomans in Mudros Harbour, my dad's island, was also in October. So it's a pretty big month. And if there's any Kyprae listening, I'm sure they'll tell you about the Oktovriana, the October events of 1931. So it's a pretty big period for most Greeks, certainly the Aegean Greeks, because that's when they found their liberation. So really keen to look into Bubulina.
Fantastic. Look, I just want to get focus back on you again. Captain of a ship, like that's massive. You're captain of a Australian warship. So does that mean you're at the helm, you've got the steering wheel, and you're driving out of Sydney Harbour? And
so it's a bit different to the movies. The commanding officer, but it's a good example. You mentioned the helm, and I guess the real title for the commanding officer would be Kivanitis in Greek, which really means, I think, the oarsman, the helmsman, which goes back to the triremes. The commanding officer is the person that's put in charge by our chief of navy, to be in command of that vessel, and each vessel has a mission to achieve, and your job is to achieve that mission, and you're given a whole bunch of resources, fuel, a ship, weapons, etc., food, but also the crew, and your role is to develop them to be war fighters, to be able to achieve whatever mission is given to you. So yes, you need to understand strategy, tactics, and naval warfare. That is a given, but you also have to have a strong sense of, I believe, people's humanistic leadership skills, empathy, to help develop your people, to make them that 1% better than anyone else that may wish to come up against us. Wow. But look, the three ships I've been lucky enough to be in command of have had different roles. I mentioned the Anzac, being in the Middle East. Hobart was a very different role. That was where we were proving ourselves on a new ship and a new weapon system in the US, and firing a whole bunch of missiles and doing some war games, which is great. But again, command comes down to developing people and being able to achieve that mission.
Okay. So you're not necessarily driving the ship out. You've got someone else that does it, but you'll tell him where to go or something like that.
No. So, for example, driving the ship or navigation, we all do our navigation training, and we have to be experts in navigation, what we call the rules of the road, you know, who gives way to who and moving around the ocean. So you have to be an expert in navigation. You have to be an expert in warfare. That's a given. Standard. But yes, we have officers. For example, the navigation officer who will drive the ship, but ultimately the captain is responsible for the manoeuvring the vessel. Wow. And certainly the captain is the person that brings the ship alongside and takes it off the wharf.
Wow. So,
and that's the part of the job I particularly love, is driving ships. It's just a lot of fun. You can imagine a Hobart-class destroyer. It's a 7,000-ton warship that just manoeuvres so beautifully, drives so well. That it's just a pleasure to be doing.
How long is the Hobart? How big?
It's about 150 metres. It's a very big ship. And like I said, 7,000 tonnes. You know, a car itself is about a tonne and a half. So you can imagine the size of the ship.
And how many sailors would you have on board?
200 is a complement of a destroyer. Mm-hmm. A frigate is a bit less, about 190. Mm-hmm. And they do different roles from victuals, you know, feeding cooks, chefs, to the electronic technicians, the radar experts, the marine technicians that look after our engines, our rudders, our air conditioning systems. Mm. You have the combat system operators, people actually, you know, if you've ever seen Top Gun, you can look in the operations room now, the red lights, the blue lights, the radar screens. Yep. It has evolved significantly since then, but that's their role.
Yeah, wow. So what's the longest you've been out at sea?
It varies. The longest I've been at sea has been 8 months. Now, that's highly unusual. I happened to be in the Middle East during the September 11 attacks. In fact, it was our last day. We had done a bit over 5 months and we were ready to go home. And that morning we were leaving and then we heard of the September 11 attacks and our government directed us to stay in the region and support the US Middle East, which we did, and ended up being an eight-month deployment. Highly unusual, though. Most deployments... we operate off Australia, which are in order of weeks. Mm-hmm. But when we do those exercises or deploy to the South China Sea or we go to the Americas, they are longer due to sheer travel time required to get from A to B. But, you know, every port, every location has got its wonders. And I've been lucky enough to travel around the world. Again, I haven't been to Greece, but I've been everywhere from the Americas, Tahiti, Hawaii.
Yeah.
Do you
have a favourite port?
Look, that would be unfair. They're all wonderful, but I keep asking my admiral if there's an opportunity to go to Greece. Well, you know, I'm your man, and I'm
good
out.
For public relations.
My only concern would be is I don't start an international incident with my broken Greek, but I'm sure I'd give it a go.
No, I didn't mean that. No. Yeah. classic.
Well, I've got to ask you. You mentioned the September 11 attacks there. Tell us a little bit about that time. Obviously, getting the call through to stay at sea for so long. What was the feeling around the Navy at that time, thinking, you know, this is real now and we could be called upon at any moment now?
Yeah, a really good question, Tom. So we were in the Middle East at the time enforcing sanctions on Iraq. So it was a different world. A lot of listeners may not even remember that time. But you can imagine after the first Gulf War, there were sanctions put on by the UN on Iraq and we were enforcing them, essentially stopping illegal trade of oil and goods out of their one port. So we're just doing patrols. And then, like I said, after 5 months, we heard the attacks and the government said to stay there and to support the US. And a lot of it was continuing doing what we're doing. But also, our immediate job was just bring some stability. A lot of people were nervous. You can imagine at the time, you know, is the next aircraft going to be in it? No, it was just, look, it's probably a one-off attack. Be on our guard. But our real job at the moment is to support our allies, but also bring some stability to the region. Again, navies exist for one purpose, that is to facilitate economic trade, movement of goods back and forth, and having a warship around certainly helps that. I mentioned previously too, you know, the threat of pirates, and you know, it's not swashbuckling, you know, people with patches and swords. Pirates are just robbers, criminals at sea, and yes, they still exist in many parts of the world, and having a warship there that can facilitate ships moving back and forth certainly gives them that confidence to continue doing so to allow trade. Mm. And indeed, most may not know this. I think one of the first few Greeks to come to Australia were pirates.
Yeah,
so you guys know that story?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I came across that story, so 2012 when I deployed to the Middle East to do piracy patrols, I thought I've got to brush up on the history of pirates in the region, and I came across this great story of these Greek pirates. I think 1827 they were captured, and it was one of the few battles that the Greece has actually fought the US. I think it was Cape Doro, where they managed to jump on a British flagged merchant vessel, and they were caught up by a US frigate at the time. And you can imagine, what were these seven Greeks thinking? They've come to Australia. I think one of them ended up staying in Australia. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a great great story nonetheless.
Yeah, true. I think one of them did stay and married and had kids and so forth. But
and that's a question I said earlier, talk to our parents, our great parents, not asking what drew you here. And a lot of it would be, there was a whole bunch of reasons Greeks came to Australia. I've mentioned, you know, World War II and that period, there was just not much employment around. People were very hungry, and the pull to Australia was strong. But the greater question is, what kept you here? We've talked about philoxenia philotimor, and it's a really hard concept to explain if you're not Greek. And how I explain it to my friends who are not Greek is mateship. And I think this is why Australians and Greeks have bonded so well, and why Greeks have done so well, because what we call in this country mateship is what we'd call philotimor philoxenia. It's just looking after your friends, looking after your mates, regardless of who it is. So that's why, why I think Greeks have done so well.
It's a great point, because I think there's an added element to that as well, though. There's a story, I'm pretty sure it was for in World War One. The difference between the British military and the Australian military, I think the story goes that an Australian group were basically digging trenches, and a British officer came past as well and said, on a horse, saying, you need to salute me because I'm a higher ranking officer. And one of the Australians jumped up out of the trench, put his coat back on, put his hat back on, and gave him a piece of his mind, because he's like, you actually need to salute me because I'm the ranking officer here. I think there's that same sort of thing, the sense of nothing is below, is below either, myself as an individual, irrespective of my rank. Is that something that still comes through? The Australians were renowned for that sort of thing in previous wars.
And still, look, we're quite egalitarian here. If you think that your rank gives you any leadership skills, then you're so mistaken in the Australian military, because the Australian sailor, Australian soldier, Australian airman will tell you, sir, excuse the language, that's bullshit, and that's exactly what you want. Otherwise, you start believing your own bullshit. Yeah. So it's wonderful how we get that feedback, because the worst thing in any leadership, but specifically a command position, is egos. Mm-hmm. For the Greek audience, understand egos, ewo, it's about me. And it's never about you. It's about the mission. It's about developing your team to help achieve that mission. And God bless the Australian sailor that keeps you honest and grounded. You're not the position you think you're in.
Yeah. Wow. Did you know that? Ego, ewo.
Actually, you know what? No.
I didn't know that either.
No.
Fantastic. Thanks for putting that.
We just learned something.
Yeah.
And I think one That's of the brilliant. Great stories of Greek, of defiance in that Greek character, you may be aware of one of the few, if not the only, incidents of mutiny on a Greek ship. You guys be too young to remember this, but one of the pull factors, again, for Greek migration was the period of the junta, the regime of the colonels. From 67 to 74, Greece was under a dictatorship.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My mum lived through it.
And again, post that, a lot of Greeks came to Australia. And I mean, the concept of dictatorship in Greece, the heart of democracy is a difficult one. And there was this one commanding officer, Nikos Pappas, who was a commander at the time, ended up being a vice admiral. He died a few years ago. And he was on NATO patrols in Italy at the time. And then mutiny said, no, we're not. This ship is not going back to Greece. All his officers and some of his crew stayed with him, and they were stripped of Greek citizenship by the junta at the time. But it really brought international attention to the situation in Greece. Mm. And a year later, the Greek junta fell.
Great stuff. Well, look, I'm running low there, Nick. So if you could just top me up with a little bit of ouzo there, a bit of Lazaris there. John, I mean,
why is the alcohol around me, Tom?
I think it's around all of us at the moment. John, the Navy historically has a thing with alcohol. We've got this whole thing about rum and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about what the culture is in the Navy now. I suspect that it will have changed over the last few hundred years.
Look, indeed. And the Royal Australian Navy's got strong links with the Royal Navy. A lot of our traditions, our spirit, our understanding has come, and we still have strong links with the Royal Navy, one of the greatest maritime powers of the world. And I've told you a lot about the Greek stories, but I also tell my sailors and officers about the great heritage we have from the Royal Navy.
Incredible.
And I think
Navy.
From the yeah, absolutely for their size, what they achieved. I think from about the 18th century, they would have alcohol at sea, more for for health benefits. Don't forget the days of scurvy, the amount of food you can actually get at sea.
That's why we drink it. It's for health benefits.
That's right.
Everything in moderation, right?
Hola me metro, as they say.
Scurvy. And most people wonder, do we drink at sea? Well, we've never, in the Royal Australian Navy, we've never had the rum ration or the rum tot, which was an imperial pint, about 70 mils they would get, sailors would get every day. But we would have a beer issue. because that's what I think we prefer at sea. But it's not a given. If a tactical situation allowed, i.e. we're just cruising from point A to point B, and those not on duty would have a beer issue, which is two cans. And how I was taught when I was a junior officer was it's two cans per person per day, perhaps. So it's certainly not a given that you'll get this. And again, it's certainly very, very controlled. I don't want to give anyone the impression that we're just drinking at sea, and certainly officers don't drink at sea. But the alcohol tradition that you mentioned previously was rum, and I think it's I suspect it's rum because the Royal Navy being in the Americas and certainly getting rum from those regions. But it's funny, we're not a trusting bunch in the Navy, and sailors at the time thought, you know, we might be getting ripped off here. Is this actually rum? Is it diluted? What are they giving us? So sailors come up with their own way of proving rum. And if you've ever heard of either Navy strength gin or Navy strength rum or something that's 100 proof, so I'm sure it's got other origins, but the story we like to say is we own everything, of course, is that sailors, what they would do, they would get gunpowder, and gunpowder at the time, potassium nitrate. And for those chemists amongst us, potassium nitrate does not dissolve in alcohol, but it does dissolve in water. So they would mix it in a rag, and if it ignited, then it meant it was 100% proof that it was alcohol. And I think the rule today is alcohol by volume is about 57-58%, means right. It's at minimum alcohol level. And they kept this rum, Todd, until the 1970s. The Royal New Zealand Navy kept it, I think, until the 80s or 90s. But like I said, the Royal Australian Navy never had that that issue.
Wow.
Well, what's the standard issue beer on an Australian ship, is it?
It's two cans, but when we're alongside, you know, the officer's mess, the senior sailor's mess have their own bar. But again, it's very controlled for very, very good reason. But,
is there a preferred
brand?
What
beer do they drink? VB?
It's changing. And if you go into a wardroom today, yes, you'll find alcohol and spirits locked away when we're at sea. But there's also a strong coffee culture too. You know ships will have my latest ship, the Hobart, which was on a Spanish design, came with proper coffee machines. One of the first things we had to do was send some of our staff to get barista courses to work out how to use these machines.
So my, how things have changed.
Certainly a strong coffee culture.
Fantastic, wow. So you mentioned before HMAS, Her Majesty's Australian Ship. Do we have to change that now?
It has changed now. It's we're in the course of changing because there's a lot of paraphernalia and things that are actually stamped with Her Majesty's. And such a sad time with the passing of Her Majesty. I don't think we all realised just how much of a strong thing she was for all of us until she actually passed. So yeah, it's now His Majesty's Australian ship.
Okay. Does it change anything? Any emblems or anything in your uniform?
More the name, and can I also say our shore bases are also called Her Majesty's, now His Majesty's Australian ship. But the crown, that won't change, and anything that does need to change will just happen over in due course, and we don't have to do anything immediately.
Yeah, okay, right. It's all your training documentation you've got to change.
Nothing. I mean, that'll happen in due course. Good thing about things like the Navy is they just go on.
Is there anything that you guys actually had to do now that you know, for the funeral or around this event?
Absolutely, we all had our National Day of Mourning a few days ago. We sent a few of our Navy to London for the funeral. A good friend of mine was actually there representing the Navy during the period. Very lucky to be selected.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned earlier about pirates. So did you ever encounter any pirates in your trips across the Pacific or the Indian Ocean or wherever you went?
Look, we did. I mentioned my first ship, the Perth, and I remember doing our first trip up through Southeast Asia. And I remember our senior warfare officers who really take you under their wing and prepare you, saying, John, you know, you're officer of the watch, the person in charge of the bridge and doing all the navigation, going through, pirate wars. This is 30 years ago now, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, son, here's your 9mm pistol. You know, make sure no pirates get on the ship. I thought, someone's pulling the piss here, right? Surely there's no pirates, right?
Yeah.
But again, if you think of pirates in terms of robbers at sea, fishermen by the day and at night. But the best thing you can do in a warship is just show that you're a warship. It's only been a few pirates have been silly enough to try and mess with warships. But
Yeah, I can't imagine they'd be lining up to take a warship on.
Well, a couple have made the mistake
Did they try and shoot at you or
not us? This is
very smart.
I believe it was a European, a European ship, may have been Dutch. I can't remember, a French ship, which I think is a tanker, but a warship tanker, and I think they saw it as a vessel and opportunistic, and then realised it was a warship that was firing back. So they moved away fairly quickly. But my period. Doing one piracy patrol up there. Again, it's all about freedom of the seas and trade moving back and forth. And what it was just understanding your environment. Context is absolutely everything in any of the operations we do. Understanding those in the area, talking to the fishermen at the time, understanding routes, etc. But by doing overt patrols, in my 6 months that we were up there, we had no piracy attacks. I was pretty proud of that. But again, getting to know the locals and them telling us, getting the intelligence where we thought the piracy attacks were. We did thwart a couple of piracy attacks underway. But again, as soon as we arrived, they pretended to be fishermen, throw their weapons over the side, the fuel, etc. And then so you can't actually arrest them if they're not in the act of piracy. But I remember one a merchant vessel told us they were under attack, and I got my helicopter up, started the chase. We eventually caught up with them. They threw over all their weapons, their boarding equipment, and just said, "Oh no, it's not us, it was the other vessels." We couldn't arrest them at the time, but successful in that we thwarted the attack.
So what about, have you had any close encounters with other navies, other submarines or planes or other ships?
Look, we regularly interact with other navies, even if it's passing. The sea is what unites all of us. And so if we do come across navies, we'll if we've got time, we'll call them up, have a chat. Again, that diplomacy mission. But I remember as a junior officer, we were in the Indian Ocean. I won't say exactly where, and every day you can imagine we test out all our weapons and our systems to make sure they work. We don't fire everything, but we just make sure they work. They're called daily system tests. And I was the anti-submarine warfare officer on this frigate, and my sailor said, "Sir, permission to radiate the sonar to test it out." We go through its modes, and approved. We're in the middle of the ocean. There's no divers in the water, nothing that we can impact. And my sailor comes back and goes, "Sir, hot new search of contact," which means a new submarine contact. I go, "Are you kidding me, right? What are you?" "No," I go, "sir, I've got something." I go, "Okay, keep exploring, keep pinging it." And about 2,000 yards, a submarine surfaced. Right? I won't say which nation it was, but just pure luck they came across the submarine. And this submarine thought they had actually been, they'd been detected and...
They surfaced.
And we had a chat with them and we all went on our way. But, it was certainly unexpected. The ocean is very, very big. To come across a submarine was quite...
And that close, 2,000 feet.
2,000 yards, yes.
Yards, sorry.
Kilometers, but it's still very close on the big scheme of things. But yeah, he surfaced. They were quite friendly. And then
I was going to say, were they friendly? Was it just a laugh?
I can't say which country it was. But we certainly worked out who they were due to the location.
Wow.
Very good.
It's a good test. Mm. Did you have any close encounters with enemies that you can maybe share with us?
If you're asking, have I been on operations? I was the operations officer of ANZAC when we were involved in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And that just shows the utility of navies. We were supporting the Marines, the Royal Marines, doing their move on the Alfour Peninsula, and we were doing what's called naval gunfire support. So we fire our gun to clear the area for the Marines to advance. But it was an interesting time. It was just over 20 years, almost 20 years ago now, and we went up what's called... the KA, the Kawar Abdullah, one of the waterways going to Iraq, a very small waterway. And even then, the intent was to use laser-guided bombs, smart bombs, to do all the attacks. But there's a wind called the Shamal. It's it's Arabic for a northerly wind. And just before the Royal Marines and the Americans went into Iraq, this Shamal came through and there was just a desert dust storm ever. You could not see your hand in front of your room.
Wow.
So we were ordered to go in, and in covered darkness we went in and started doing our mission off Iraq. But as we were going up that night, and it was pretty quiet, There's just no one around, but we saw two vessels leaving Iraq, and there were two targets, so we call them up and ordered them, go to Ankara and we'll inspect you in the morning, which we did, and we sent one of the other coalition Australian ship to have a look, and they said, they're not targets, it's a mine-laying ship, and guess what, they're missing three mines. And I thought, oh great, we're in the middle of a minefield now. Wow. Now, the captain of that vessel told us, no, I haven't laid any mines, but there were still three missing, we brought a whole bunch of mine hunters in, cleared the area fairly quickly so we can continue on with our mission.
So you located those three mines?
No, never found them. I suspect that tugboat captain never actually laid them because they were just leaving. I think we caught them just as they were leaving to do that role.
Wow. So what else is out there in the Pacific Ocean? Have you ever bumped into any lost sailors?
We have any
SOSs?
Yeah, so it's a big ocean. When I was
thinking of the movie Castaway here.
Have you located Wilson?
Yeah, where's Wilson?
I certainly haven't located any lost islands or the like. But when I was a captain of Arunta with our sister ship, another ship, HMAS Success, which is now decommissioned, we were through South China Sea, through the Indonesian archipelago. You know, we were just a couple of miles apart, and the HMAS Success said, man overboard, we're just going to stop and pick someone up in the ocean. And we regularly exercise man overboard, a whole bunch of things, so we keep our skills up. And I was a senior ship, and I said, yeah, approved. Let me know when your exercise is completed. I guess, no, it's not an exercise, there's a man in the water. And I said, you've got to be kidding me, right? The chances in the middle of the ocean finding... and it was a sailor that had fallen over his fishing boat, and the crew of the Success found him, got him on board, got him bathed, a whole bunch of clothes, and everyone just donated all the Indonesian money they had to this sailor. And we're told later on he was able to put his kids through school and the like. So it's a great story that... you know, this lost soul was able to be found. And as I said earlier, what unites us all is the sea. And there's a great book and a great movie called The Cruel Sea. And it just shows, it's a story about the individual and how difficult it is at sea and fighting those elements. Again, what unites us all, regardless of what navy you may be in, or merchant marine, etc., or tugboat captain, how the sea unites us all.
Well, what about those conditions? I mean... Talk to us a little bit about the weather and high seas and whatnot. It must be frightening, at the very least, in some weather conditions.
It can be, and we've gone close to cyclones, but we generally avoid them. I've been through some pretty monstrous seas, but they are quite rare. And especially today, my background too is a meteorologist. We know the most efficient ways to get from A to B, and where we can, we'll avoid bad weather. But most of the times, the weather is actually quite beautiful. And some of the most memorable times I have is being at sea on the bridge of a ship. Everything's quite, you can imagine it's nighttime. We only have a bit of red lighting just so you can see your instruments. It's completely calm, sea state, what we call sea state zero. Stars by their absolute, their brilliance. And you just sit out there, and all you can hear is just the ship cutting through the water. It is such a peaceful time to be at sea, and that's some of the most memorable moments I have of being on a bridge.
Wow. So. Well, Nick, you mentioned something off air earlier. You had a question about, would you ever feel sort of tempted to throw a line in and go fishing?
Does that sort of stuff? We do. Well, absolutely. If you've got time.
Or a net.
There's lots of fishermen on our ships. If we come across a good shoal and we have time type to stop, we'll just stop the ship and then go fishing and hopefully have a nice fish meal for dinner. The other thing we do is stop and have what we call a swimex. Just get our boat in the water and people jump off the ship and go for a swim.
I've noticed there was a clip on YouTube where a couple of sailors jumped off. I'm pretty sure they were sailors in the middle of the ocean.
I think that was an aircraft carrier. I think I saw that one as well.
And then a shark appears out of nowhere. And then there's a guy on the gunner, and I think he started to shoot at the shark.
I haven't seen that YouTube clip, but we do take precautions. Believe it or not, there's a risk calculator, so you know the risk of sharks depending on temperature, where you are in the world. And if we think the risk is manageable... We'll stop, we'll have that swimex, but we'll also put our two sea boats in the water. And yes, we'll have gunners manned up, ready just in case there is a shark. And no, we're not around out there to kill sharks, right? Yeah. But, we may fire warning shots if we see them, but the aim is if we do find a shark in the area, we get out of the what it's their domain, and you know, you have to respect it. I still remember as a junior officer, one of the first times we had a swim-ex, and I'd never come across it. It was fantastic. We're just going to stop on a destroyer and go for a swim. And the navigator made a broadcast, what we call a pipe, and said, everyone, just let you know, the nearest land is 6,000 metres away. And everyone's looking around, surely not 6 kilometres away. And he goes, right below you. So there we were swimming. This was in the Indian Ocean, swimming, and you know, the nearest point of land was just 6 kilometres below us. And just, it was just absolutely wonderful.
What's it like looking into that, though, swimming in an ocean where you just can't see any land anywhere?
It's crystal blue. Really? Absolutely. Wow. Beautiful. But of course you can only see a few meters below you. It's just absolutely lovely. Some of the warmest temperatures that we had.
Kidding. Wow. What ocean was this?
This is the Indian Ocean. On our transit, we've done it at many places, including the South Pacific, which is also lovely. Some of the warmest waters are in the South Pacific to our north, and in Southeast Asia.
Unbelievable.
Is it true the Atlantic Ocean is very grey and the Pacific's very blue? And I've seen, again, it's only on YouTube clips I've seen, where there's a divide of the Atlantic and the Pacific where they meet, and there's a contrast of colours between the two oceans.
Yes, but you know, the ocean's large, Atlantic's huge, Pacific's even larger, so you'll get different conditions in different locations. And it's all based on biodiversity, what's living in the ocean, the temperature, its location, etc. So based on temperature and location, you'll get different clarities.
Have you bumped into any whales at all?
I've seen many whales, and that is just never bumped into any whales. But again, on our sonars, you can listen to them and their whale songs.
Kidding.
Because we're always got our senses on. We're listening to our environment. You have to be attuned to your environment. So it's always wonderful listening to those whale songs, and seeing many many whales, albatross, birds. It's just a lovely lovely to be at sea. I keep saying every sailor you come across will always have a story to tell, because you're just blessed to see so much being on the oceans or in various ports of the world.
Wow.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, all of us have seen films about the Navy, films about war and whatnot. We mentioned it earlier, Nick and I are, you know, huge fans of watching things like that. Which films do you think most accurately depict life in the Navy? Or which films have really sort of resonated with you when it comes to, you know, the depiction of life in the military?
Really good question. I used to watch a lot of films with my dad, war films growing up. And most people miss a point in most war films. They're actually anti-war. Mm. You know, they're not glorifying war. They're more focused on the individual and what they go through. One of the earliest movies I did see was The Cruel Sea, based on Nicholas Montserrat's book. It's about patrols in the Atlantic against the German U-boats. Again, that a wonderful movie about life at sea as a junior officer. But look, I'll be honest with you, I've also enjoyed movies like Top Gun. You know, it's a bit of things like watching Top Gun, I've certainly enjoyed. I haven't seen the most recent version, Top Gun Maverick, so please don't spoil
good.
It for me.
It's pretty good. It's very good.
But certainly growing up, another one I just love, not because it's about Greece. I remember Guns of Navarone, watching that with Dad.
Great film.
A good mate of mine from school, Gary Pavlis. I was lucky enough to go to Trinity Grammar when I was a kid. Back then, it's full of Greeks now, but back then I think there were three of us. Gary Pavlis was one. Evan Panopoulos was another friend
of mine.
Did
you say Gary
Pavlis? Yeah, Penta Properties, yeah.
Yeah, I know very well.
he and I went to the same school. We laughed. We did cadets together, but Trinity now is full of Greeks, which is a good thing. It's a very, very good school. And I remember watching that movie, Guns of Navarone, which is primarily about the Dodecanese campaign and the island of Leros, which Gary, my friend, is from. And one of the scenes I still remember, and if you've seen the movie, it shows, we've talked about Philox and Philotimor, that Greek wedding scene where Gregory Peck and the British Special Forces turn up to the wedding scene. And they sing that movie, Yalo Yalo. And for those that do not, and most regions in Greece will have their own version of Yalo Yalo. And I know you're from Corfu. They have their own version about the Eptanis, so the Eptanese. And everyone knows the Dodecanese, but the Eptanis are the Ionian Islands, which has got a great history. And Christine Douglas does a great song about those islands. And another movie I particularly enjoy is Captain Crowley's Mandolin. One of your neighbouring islands, yes. Kefalonia.
Which is pretty accurate, apparently, when, you know, when it comes to the relationship between the locals and the Italians, and then the with the Germans as well.
Yeah, a tragic story. In that period where, you know, Mussolini was ousted, and the Italians had a choice. You know, do we go back home? Do we lay down our arms and give to the Germans, or do we fight? And you know, you talk about those values. They'd built bonds with the Greek community at the time, and they chose to fight. And you know, not only I think 1,000 of the 33rd Division were killed during the fight. Then 5,000 were massacred by the Germans, and this happened on other islands too. And then, as fate has it, when they were prisoners of war transiting back, their vessel was sunk by an Allied submarine, so another 3,000 died. So, you know, it's a tragic story. But certainly a wonderful movie. But getting back to the Battle of Leros as part of the Dodecanese campaign, great movie about the guns of Navarone, and it was all based on Alistair MacLean's book. And I believe the guns, whilst fictional, Navarone's not an island, as you know, but I believe it was based on Crete. And again, it's another part of our national history. I've mentioned Orchidae, the battle for Greece. And again, the Australian Navy was heavily involved in the evacuations, not only in the battles for Greece, our wonderful troops, the second Anzacs, but also we had a number of ships involved in the evacuation of Greece, then to Crete, and then the battle of Crete itself. So wonderful stories that we can all learn from.
Absolutely. Mm. I guess the majority of people listening into this, and the majority of people who are like Nick and I, who, you know, watch these films and read the books and the documentaries and all that sort of thing, that's the only ever contact that we're going to have with life in the armed forces. For someone who might be thinking about joining the Navy, for example, you know, someone who, you know, maybe has kids who want to join the Navy, what would you say to them? What's life like in the Navy in 2022?
It's a wonderful career. And in fact, I mentioned earlier why I choose to stay in the Navy is because it's given me so many opportunities and so many jobs within one career. Everything, Navy's values professional development and education, and that's something I think people of Greek background certainly value quite a lot. Apart from doing my basic education, they're always sending me on leadership courses. Indeed, they asked me to be a meteorologist. I went and did a meteorology course. I always wanted to be an accountant, so I did my CPA qualification sponsored through the Navy. They saw value in that, so it's something they always do. And again, not everyone that joins the Navy wants to be a warfare officer or a captain of a ship. You can be a logistician, you can be a chef, you can be an electronics technician, a marine technician, supply officers, etc. There's many, many careers. You can be a legal officer, you can be a doctor, a nurse. There's so many careers within the career. But it is an unknown. So if there are people out there that are interested, or more importantly, the kids may be interested and the parents are thinking, well, you know, is this the right career for my daughter or for my son? More than happy to have the conversation, tell them what life is really, really like. But certainly, I love the Navy. It's looked after me. I found that that discipline they provide. And I'm not talking about discipline of punishment. I'm talking about discipline giving that sense of purpose, something common good that you unite and work as a team towards. I still certainly find that as one of the strengths of the Navy. If anyone's got any questions, more than happy, you can contact me through UzoTalk, and happy to talk to any parents or people that may be thinking of joining up.
Yeah, definitely. Look, if anyone's out there, look, reach out to us. We'll get in contact with John, and any questions you have, we're happy to get John to answer them for you.
And the email is uzotalk@outlook.com. So yeah, if you do have any questions that you'd like to pass on to John, we'll happily take those emails and pass them on. Nick, I mean, what do we say about this? I mean, we've learned so much, obviously, and it's been a great insight into, you know, into something that you and I probably don't know enough about, but it yet is so important to how our society functions.
It is. And look, and just another great example of, you know, someone with a Greek heritage doing really well in another industry that we wouldn't even have a clue about. You know,
absolutely.
Amazing insights, John. Honestly, you've blown us away. I've got 1,000 other questions, but look, I don't know where to start and begin with all this sort of stuff. But
I think the key message, though, is that, John, you know, seeing people like yourself doing the work that you're doing, it makes us proud. It's something that we can say to our kids, look at what our people are doing in our society. It would be exactly the same thing in the US with Greeks there. And I think you mentioned earlier, you know, wherever Greeks go, you know, they sort of make a go of it. this is another example, and we're so proud to have had you here.
Well, thank you very much. Again, it was a real honour for me to come here. You've enriched my life. Listen to your podcast, listen to all those other wonderful Greeks that do such amazing things. And again, I just see myself as one of those other Greeks doing a lot of good things, as you guys are too. Thank you.
Well, please keep doing it, because, as I said, it's inspirational for us. It's inspirational for our kids.
Definitely.
Mate, please keep us safe.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. And look, honestly, John, very inspirational. Some of the stuff that you said, you know, it's a light bulb moment in my own head. You know, the values that I didn't realize why I had these values, but the way you've just articulated it, it's very sentimental to our upbringings, Tom.
Absolutely.
And every other Greek out there.
Absolutely. John, thank you so much for being here. We've enjoyed every second of it. And mate, I'm sure we'll cross paths again in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Bevia. Appreciate your time.
Nice definitely will, mate. Thank you so much for this.
Fantastic. Well, look, the email is uzotalk@outlook.com. Follow us on social media at uzotalk on most social media platforms, or at @uzo_talk on Instagram. Nikathanasiou, thank you very much, mate.
Tom, champion, you're a legend. Thank you.
See you next time.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.